It is another week. This is Andrew Wood, Executive Director of Hope Resource Center. Thank you so much for tuning in. You can learn more about Hope at investinghope.com. Of course, you can listen to the show every single Tuesday afternoon at 5 o'clock live on Joy 620, or you can listen to the archive of the podcast at investinghope.com, at TuneIn app, at iTunes, Google Play, wherever podcasts are found. You can find this. It's called A Conversation on Life with yours truly, Andrew Wood. And so thank you again for listening. We have a lot to talk about today. One thing I do want to point out, if you're local and listening, man, this rain has just been something else. I feel like I'm one of the old guys now that talk about the weather. And so I find myself saying, man, this rain, wow, this rain, look at that rain, look at this weather. Yeah, that's where I'm at. One thing I do want to point out, this gave me an opportunity the other day. This has nothing to do with what I'm going to be talking about today, but it does have something to do with being a dad and what this rain, what this weather allows for. And so here's just some things that it allows for. Here's some conversations. I picked my kids up from school last Thursday because school closed early, and so I went and picked them up, and instead of going straight home, we went riding. We went riding back roads and looking at the flood, and because that's what I used to do with my dad. And so that's what I decided to do with my kids. They didn't want to go home yet, so we went and looked at the water in a number of different places. And I found myself saying some things that I didn't really, until after the conversation, I realized, oh, I'm officially like an old dad. And so here's some of the things I said while we were driving down the road. I found myself going, goodness gracious, look at that water. That was one thing that I said. Another thing I said was, sakes alive, look at that. Look at that creek up. And then I would say, man alive, look at that creek is up over there. And then I would say, we haven't seen this much flooding since Noah. That was another thing that I found myself saying, which is what my parents said growing up. I would say, we haven't seen this much flooding since, last year. We haven't seen this much flooding since the mid-90s. Or, you know, you fill in the blank what year that was. I said this. We were driving in Powell, and if you're familiar with the Knoxville area, the small town of Powell feels everything is flooded. The baseball fields, the softball fields, everything was flooded in Powell. And I actually said this to my kids. I said, I think that's the highest I've ever seen that creek get up. Another thing we say. And then I found myself looking at my children and going, God promised he would never flood the earth again, which is a normal thing we say when it is flooding. I told my kids, I said, when I was a kid, I would go out in the field and play when it was flooded. And then my kids, of course, asked, well, so can we go outside and play? And I said, no, you may not. What kind of parent would that make me? And then I found myself driving by small farms in the area, and I said, I hope they get the cows and horses up out of that field before the rain. And then my favorite thing that I say when it rains like this is, dadgum, look at that water. That's a go-to must for the Wood family. So hopefully you had some moments. Hopefully you didn't have any water in your house. If you did, hopefully you got that taken care of. But hopefully you had some moments with family to talk about what's going on and to have a little fun with it in the midst of the rain. It's hard. It's hard to be upbeat when we have as much rain as we have. So what we want to do today is talk about a couple of things going on around the country. We're going to look at a big-time win for a pro-life organization on campus. A court made a decision that was a positive thing for pro-lifers. We're also going to look at just last week, last Friday, the worst time ever to have a presidential debate is Friday night. And so the Democratic Party had a presidential debate on Friday night. We're going to briefly talk about that. And then we're going to shift and look at a lot of conversations are occurring right now concerning late-term abortion. And there are some folks saying that's not a real thing. No one has a late-term abortion. Some are saying that's not even a medical term. So we're going to look at that and look at why it's important to have laws on the books that outlaw abortions late in the pregnancy. And so a number of things to look at. We're going to start at the Washington Examiner first, And the headline is, latest blow against campus censorship offers huge win for pro-life movement. So the article written by Nicole Russell, again, over at the Washington Examiner, says this. It's a big win for free speech. A lawsuit between a pro-life student group and a university has finally been resolved after a federal judge ruled that the university had discriminated against the group and a settlement was reached. California State University agreed to change its policies for student fees and pay more than $240,000 following the federal court's ruling. This is a win for all student groups, but especially for those that espouse traditional, conservative, or minority views. The backstory tells a chilling tale of campus censorship. The president of the school's chapter of Students for Life, Nathan, wanted to host a visiting speaker on, quote, abortion and human equality, and cover the person's travel expenses, approximately $500. Despite the fact that all students pay a fee toward student groups, this particular organization was not allowed to access these funds and was told that student fees cannot cover travel costs. Meanwhile, the university did use the students' fees to fund two community centers, the Gender Equity and the LGBTQA Pride Centers, at the cost of nearly $300,000. Okay, so let's stop right there. Pro-life organization wanted to use student fees to pay for the travel of a speaker to come to campus, $500. The campus said, no, those fees cannot be used for that, even though the campus used the student fees to pay for the Gender Equity and LGBTQ Pride Centers at the cost of nearly $300,000. In 2017, Alliance Defending Freedom, attorneys representing the organization and the pro-life student group filed a lawsuit challenging the university's discriminatory funding policies, which clearly funded some ideological groups but not others. In August 2019, a federal district court struck down the university's policy. Both sides have reached an agreement, and the case is just recently closed. The judge's order provides hope for all student groups that might represent minority, traditional, or otherwise controversial views. The order said, the order said that the pro-life student group does have a First Amendment interest in not being compelled to contribute to an organization whose expressive activities conflict with their own beliefs. Later, the judge said, the undisputed evidence shows plaintiffs paid mandatory student fees, which may have amounted to compelled speech. And finally, that the Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld that the First Amendment generally precludes public universities from denying student organizations access to school-sponsored forums because of the group's viewpoints. Allison, who is Director of External Affairs of Live Action, provided their perspective from the view of a pro-life group. While we are pleased that California State University San Marcos is revising its policy in the wake of their unconstitutional discrimination against the pro-life club on campus, we must realize it took 3 years and the litigation of powerhouse Alliance Defending Freedom for the administration to come to their senses and respect the First Amendment rights of pro-life students. Live Action goes further. The revision of policy at California State University, the largest public university in California with almost 500,000 students and 23 campuses, benefits all students and their ability to engage in the free exchange of ideas. Live Action makes an important point. While this decision is sound and often a settlement is preferred and less costly over continued litigation toward the Supreme Court, it's unfortunate that these cases take so long and require significant legal action to resolve them, particularly when the First Amendment violations are so egregious. Despite the victory here, this case demonstrates the unequal playing field conservatives and minority students face every day on college campuses. It shouldn't take a bevy of lawyers to protect a small pro-life group on a college campus from discrimination, all while liberal groups and causes receive preferential treatment. And so that was happening in California, and I get it. If you're listening here in Tennessee, you're going, well, what does that have to do with me? This has to do with freedom of speech. It has to do with what's going on campuses across this country. And it has to do with folks that claim to be tolerant. Okay, so they claim to be tolerant. That, look, we want to be accepting of everybody's ideas and everybody's opinions and everybody has a seat at the table. Except for when a pro-life group comes up and says, hey, we want to use the student fees that we've been paying. We've been paying with our own money. We want to use these student fees to simply pay for the travel expenses of a speaker. And they're told, no, you can't access these fees. And then they lie to the group and say it's because these fees are not used for travel costs, when the reality is they didn't let them use the fees because they were a pro-life organization. And they don't fit the model. They don't fit the narrative of the day. How dare this pro-life organization believe that life is precious? How dare this pro-life organization believe that abortion is wrong? And so what we had here is we had a student, or not even a student, we had a university administration look at a student group on campus and say, simply because of your belief system, you're not going to be able to access the funds that all other students are able to access, even though you have paid for the fees yourself. And then it took 3 years. And it took a powerhouse organization like Alliance Defending Freedom. And if you're not familiar with them, look them up. They've won cases at the Supreme Court level. They've won cases at every level. They are fighting for religious freedom. They won a big case for pregnancy centers just a couple years ago at the Supreme Court level, protecting pregnancy centers. Guess where that was occurring? What state was attacking pregnancy centers? California. And so Alliance Defending Freedom steps up and takes care of this, but it shouldn't have to get to that point. But we have reached a level in society where just because you disagree with us, we're gonna change the rules. And so on a public institution where students are paying student fees and student fees are all used for the same thing, this campus chose to pay $300,000 for LGBTQ pride centers, but wouldn't give a pro-life organization $500 simply to pay the travel expenses of a speaker. Think about that. You see, so that's why this matters. It matters because We have religious freedom. It matters because we have the freedom of speech. It matters because our students, and in a lot of cases, our parents, if you have a student in college, a lot of parents are paying that bill. A lot of parents are writing checks, Christian, pro-life parents, writing checks, paying fees at these college campuses, and then they're being told, well, your beliefs aren't good here. Your beliefs aren't welcome here. You can take that pro-lifeness somewhere else. You can take your religion somewhere else. But the amazing thing about this case is it's certainly a big victory for the pro-life organization, but it's a big victory for campus groups in general. That's what we get with freedom of speech. It's not just for religious folks. It's not just for pro-life folks. It's not just for Christians. It's not just for evangelicals. It's not just for Catholics. No, it's for every citizen. And the frustrating part is that it took 3 years and attorney fees and attorney hours to finally get to a point where we got the settlement and we got the decision that should have been made immediately. And so it's interesting times. As we think about what's going on high school campuses, as we think about what's going on college campuses, as we think about our pro-lifeness, what I'm going to be talking about after the break is what happened Friday night at the debate, where not one candidate could stand and say there should be any restrictions on abortion. Not one. And so it's no wonder that a pro-life mindset, a pro-life ethic is not welcome. Senator Sanders, speaking just the other day at a town hall, when asked, does the Democratic Party have room for pro-life Democrats? His answer was, I believe being pro-choice is fundamental to being a Democrat. In essence saying, no. Pro-life Democrats are not welcome in this party. Apparently socialists are, but not pro-life Democrats. So it's no wonder when a student group, a pro-life organization student group, seeks to simply get $500 out of their student fees that they're already paying, are told no. We'll talk more about the debate from Friday night when we come back. Well, I just couldn't bear the thought of people living in poverty, children sold into slavery. The thought disgusted me, so I shook my fist at heaven. I said, God, why don't you?
something. He said I did. Yeah. I created you.
Now listen.
If not us, then who?
That's right. God said, I created you, so get off your hind end and do something. I mean, I think that's ultimately what we are to do as Christians. And so as we look at what's going on around the country and around the globe when it comes to pro-lifeness, over the next few weeks, months, you're going to hear me talking a lot about what's happening in Washington. And the reason is because we're an election year. And so it's 2020. It is election time. We'll either get 4 more years of the current president, or we will have a new candidate come in. And right now, in terms of those that have a D beside their name and are running in the presidential primary, they are really, just this past Friday, really showed their true colors when it came to abortion. And there's a piece over at the New York Times. That's right. I am going to read an article from the New York Times discussing this. Stephanie Saul wrote the piece, and she's talking about the in-depth discussion that happened at the debate on Friday night. And it's important because it's really the most in-depth, if you can have that in today's debate environment, discussion. And the fact of the matter is there's no diversity in terms of abortion and life and the folks involved in the Democratic primary. It is, they're all for abortion anytime, for any reason, at any point during the pregnancy. And also, just to throw this in there, they think you as a taxpayer should pay for it. So let's look at the article over at the New York Times. In their most in-depth debate statements to date on abortion, several of the leading Democratic presidential candidates reaffirmed on Friday night that if elected, they would put forward only Supreme Court nominees who supported Roe v. Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court decision establishing a woman's right to abortion. Historically, many presidential candidates have shied away from an outright litmus test on abortion or any other issue, arguing that Supreme Court justices should not be selected based on their political positions, but on their experience and jurisprudence. But that has changed this campaign cycle. Now, that's important to note. What they were saying on the debate stage was they are putting in a litmus test. Hey, if you are a conservative judge that would say Roe v. Wade might have been a questionable decision, they're not going to put you on the court. They're not even going to nominate you. And this is why I've been saying that conservatives should always say, no, if you believe Roe v. Wade was the right decision, then we're not going to have you on our list. Because Roe v. Wade was a wrong decision. From a judicial standpoint, it was not a good, solid, constitutionally based decision, much less Casey versus Planned Parenthood in 1992. But that's a story for another day. So let's get back to the article. The Democratic candidates have also gone a step further and urged that the right to abortion be legislated, a call that several repeated on Friday during the discussion of an issue whose absence from previous debates has angered advocates. And then it says here, Senator Elizabeth Warren, running for president, said this, quote, "I've lived in America in which abortion was illegal, and rich women still got abortions, and that's what we have to remember about this." So she wants rich and poor people to get abortions, apparently. That is Senator Warren's position. She believes that Roe v. Wade should be codified, meaning a law should be passed that allows for the right to abortion across the country. She goes further, quote, "Three out of every four people in America believe right now that the rule of Roe v. Wade should be the law," Ms. Warren said. "That means we should be pushing for a congressional solution as well. It is time to have a national law to protect the right of a woman's choice." The interesting thing that Senator Warren leaves out there is also, if you look at polls, the vast majority of the populace believes that some type of restriction should be in place for abortion, period. So if you're going to go by the polls, if you're going to go by what the populace wants, the majority of folks want some type of restriction. Not one candidate currently in the Democratic primary wants any restrictions. Ms. Warren goes further. States are heading toward trying to ban abortion outright, and the Supreme Court seems headed in exactly that direction as well. If we are going to protect the people of the United States of America, and we are going to protect our rights to have dominion over our own bodies, then it's going to mean we can't simply rely on the courts. Now, I would agree we shouldn't simply rely on the courts. We've been saying that as pro-lifers as well. But it's interesting to see what Senator Warren said about dominion over our own bodies. You see, because I can look at my four children, Gavin, Summer, Evelyn, Charlie, all individuals. They all have their own fingerprints, their own blood type. They have their own organs, their own arms, their own legs, their own fingers, their own toes, their own hair color, their own eyes, their own ears. So do they get to have dominion over their own body when they're growing in the womb? Or someone else gets to have dominion over that? You see, when we start throwing these words around that sound good on the campaign trail, they need to be questioned. So who gets the right to have dominion over whose body? Because when you're pregnant, there is another body growing inside of you. If you're hearing my voice right now, you once were growing inside of someone else. So when do we draw the line? And the article goes further. The exchange began when former Vice President Joe Biden, also pledging that if the Supreme Court were to rule abortion unconstitutional, he would ask Congress to pass a bill codifying Roe v. Wade. He says, quote, "It's a woman's right to do that, period. And if you call that a litmus test, well, it's a litmus test," end quote. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota said she would appoint only justices who respected precedent. Now this, listen to this. "And one of those key precedents is Roe v. Wade," she said. "In addition, you have got to put it into law." Now for a while, we had precedent that said marriage was between one man and one woman. For a while, we had precedent that said some in our society could be enslaved. For a while, we had precedent that said women couldn't vote. For a while, we had precedent that said some people could use certain water fountains and others couldn't use it. So simply saying they got to respect precedent, that's insane. Sure, we respect precedent to a point. But just because there was a decision in 1973 that claimed every woman has a right to an abortion doesn't mean that we can't even address the issue ever again. That's ridiculous. And it's laughable that a presidential candidate would be bringing that up as an argument, because we overrule precedent all the time. Ms. Klobuchar warned that President Trump in some states had suggested criminalization of abortion when he was running for election. And in this case, I will make on the debate stage against him, he actually said that he wanted to put women in jail. He then dialed it back and said, "No, I want to put doctors in jail." She said, "It is a big surprise then we are seeing states like Alabama start enacting laws that would criminalize doctors who perform abortions." It's not. See, listen to what she said. "I don't know of any state that has passed a law that would criminalize the mom." There are certainly states that have looked to criminalize the doctor performing the abortion. But see, she conflated the two. And then so she immediately said there are states that want to criminalize abortion and go after women. She then mentioned that what Trump said back during the campaign that he did backtrack on, and I called him out on this show for saying it. But then she immediately went to Alabama enacting laws that would criminalize doctors that say nothing about criminalizing the mom. So again, that's a straw man. That's not a true solid argument. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont also demanded codification of Roe v. Wade. He said, "Look, you asked a simple question," Mr. Sanders said. "Is there a litmus test for those of us up here? For me, there is. I will never nominate any person to the Supreme Court or the federal courts in general who is not 100% pro Roe v. Wade. Number two, if we have to codify Roe v. Wade into legislation." Now think about that. If a Republican candidate, if a conservative candidate came out and just flat out said, "I'll never nominate a judge to any federal court or the Supreme Court that would say Roe v. Wade is okay." Now, I want the candidates to come out and say that, but they won't. We won't even have Kavanaugh on the stand, Gorsuch on the stand. They won't even address Roe v. Wade. Now, I think I believe where they, I know where they stand on the issue. But they wouldn't flat out say I'm against what Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. They go further. We all have the litmus test. Everybody on this row feels exactly the same way about a woman's right to choose, Tom Steyer said. There's something else going on. The Republicans are in control, he added. They're stacking the court for a generation with young right-wing radicals. And we've watched it happen, and the question is, what are we going to do about it? So you hear that. So now, if you are a originalist to the Constitution and you believe that Roe v. Wade was mishandled and was not a good judgment, and you believe the Constitution says what it says, they're now calling you a right-wing radical. And they said that they're stacking the courts with these young right-wing radicals simply because they would argue that a person has value. And that value, that inherent value begins at conception, not after the baby leaves the womb. That the baby, the human, the individual, has individual rights and value from conception to death, all the way. And now they're calling that a right-wing radical position. You see, this is why these conversations are important. This is why, as hard as it is to watch these debates, and I'll be honest, I haven't watched many of them. I've seen highlights and read articles about them after the fact. But this is why it's important that these questions get asked. This is why it's important we get them on the record saying where they stand. You heard right there, Tom Steyer said, every one of us on this row, every one of us in this debate believe that it should be a litmus test for court judges. That should matter to us. We'll talk more when we come back. Here am I, send me. Yeah. Here am I, send me. Until every nation should know the power of your love. Give me a hunger to know where it is you want me to go. Father, I'm saying, here am I, send me. So the conversation continues, as it always does. And so as we look at what's being said on the debate stage, as we look at court decisions that are being made out in California, and as we're about to look at some decisions that are coming out of Washington when it comes to life and the protection of it, the reason why it's important to look at what's happening legislatively and in the courts and on the front lines at pregnancy centers is because all of that is connected. All of it's connected. And so if we allow ourselves to actually be honest about this debate and this conversation, we have gone from, not too long ago, safe, legal, and rare. Not too long ago, that was the mantra. That's all we want with abortion, is safe, legal, and rare. And that's something a lot of people can get behind. Of course, no one wants an abortion, and we want it to be rare. Of course, we want it to be safe. Of course, we don't want people doing things illegal. We want them to have the opportunity. So you see, that's why that mantra is a good mantra in terms of strategy. I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm saying in terms of just strictly strategy, that's a good line. Safe, legal, rare. It rolls off the tongue. It fits. A lot of people can say that. Then they can feel like they're doing something. They can say, look, I'm not pro-abortion, but man, I do believe it needs to be safe, legal, and rare, and it's not happening that often. I believe that a lot of folks don't believe it's happening. I think if you sat down most folks and said, do you know how many abortions occurred in this country last year? They'll have no clue. No clue. And then when you look at them and say, you know, 700,000, 800,000, that's how many. I think many of them would be taken aback by that. I think then if you looked at them and said, do you know how many of those were done based on rape and incest? And they would probably guess a very high number. And you would look at them and go, actually, it's less than 1% of all abortions are due to that. So, you know, most abortions are done because of financial situation, because of convenience, because of, I don't want this baby. The guy walked out. There's no support. All those are real, real decisions. Don't get me wrong. All those are real effects and consequences, and we need to deal with those. But if we just sit around and act like these things aren't happening, we're lying to ourselves. And so that's why it's important to understand what's happening. So when we see presidential candidates, when we see our neighbors, when we see people in our community say, well, no one is pro-abortion, and then we push back on that and go, well, then explain to me what happened at the debate Friday night if no one's pro-abortion. If no one's pro-abortion, then explain to me hashtag shout your abortion on Twitter. If no one's pro-abortion, then explain to me how these organizations celebrate abortion every chance they get. If no one is pro-abortion, why do they get mad at a Doritos ad that say, and they say that Doritos ad, because it showed an ultrasound, humanized a fetus? Well, how can you humanize a fetus? It is a human. Like, you know that, right? So there are absolutely folks out there that are pro-abortion. There's a doctor on social media just the other day. She's a big pro-choice advocate that said, I am 100% pro-abortion. Don't see anything wrong with it. At least she's being honest. And so that's why we talk about these things, because I want you to get an understanding of the conversations that are happening in our society, that are happening in Washington. So we're not going to be surprised when they make it to us. So we're not going to wait till election day and go, wait, all of those candidates are pro-abortion? No, if you've been listening to this show, you know that they all have been for a long time. And so there's a great piece over at National Review written by John McCormick. And the headline is, should any late-term abortion be illegal? And he says that he's been talking to Democrats in Washington. He's been talking to pro-choice advocates in Washington, and none of them will say one way or the other. Their bill would eliminate almost all limits nationwide. Congressional Democrats responded to a spate of state laws aimed at restricting abortion on Thursday by reintroducing the Women's Health Protection Act. The measure wouldn't merely prohibit states such as Georgia and Alabama from banning abortion early in pregnancy if Roe v. Wade were overturned. It would also invalidate most state laws limiting late-term abortion, including Pennsylvania's 24-week limit, under which notorious abortionist Kermit Gosnell was convicted in 2013 for killing 21 infants in utero, in addition to his conviction of murdering 3 infants with scissors after they had been born. So when people say, When people say, look, no one is pro-abortion, when people say, look, late-term abortions aren't happening, we had very strict laws on the books in Pennsylvania, and you had Kermit Gosnell. Okay, he wasn't just killing babies in the womb late in the pregnancy. He was actually having them born and then killing them after they were born, and called himself an abortion doctor. The article goes further. Indeed, it would wipe out almost all state limits on abortion, including mandatory waiting periods and ultrasound requirements off the books. Essentially, congressional Democrats seek to take the standard for late-term abortion proposed earlier this year in Virginia and shelved after the bill's chief sponsor acknowledged it would allow abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy if a lone doctor asserted it was necessary for mental health reasons, and imposed it on every state that provides greater protection for unborn children late in pregnancy. Now, the Virginia piece of legislation just mentioned, I talked about last week on the show, so if you want to know more about that, you can listen to last week's show. The federal legislation would require states to permit abortion after an unborn child is viable, that is, old enough to survive outside the womb. Now, just recently at the State of the Union address, we had a mom and her little girl, a little girl that was born at 21 weeks and is now 2 years old. 21 weeks and is now 2 years old. If a single doctor asserts that an abortion is necessary to protect the mother's health, then abortion is okay by this law. The text of the bill explicitly instructs the courts to, quote, liberally interpret the legislation. And the bill doesn't distinguish between physical and mental health, as its chief sponsor, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, has said. Now, think about that. You know, when these candidates, when folks go around, not just candidates, but when anybody you talk to goes around and says, look, we need to worry about the health of the mom. I think most rational, honest people, when they hear that, they think, well, if you don't get an abortion, this mom's going to die. And so when you hear that, you go, well, we need to fight to save lives. And if we got to fight, then we need to do everything we can to make sure both lives are okay. But the reality is, when they say life of the mother, health of the mother, they don't mean physical health necessarily. That's included. But they also mean mental health. Are they depressed? What's their financial health like? That's when it says we're going to interpret this liberally. It means mental health, physical health, any kind of health. It could mean anything. Absolutely anything. Earlier this week in the Capitol building, the article of this piece had a chance to talk to Senator Blumenthal and ask him some questions. He said, is there any reason abortion should ever be legal on a healthy fetus, healthier mother, healthy mother, physically healthy, that is, after viability? Blumenthal said, I'm not sure what you mean. The author said, is there any reason late-term abortion should be legal when the mother is physically healthy and the fetus is physically healthy? Blumenthal, I'm really not going to deal with hypotheticals. We're reintroducing the Women's Health Protection Act. And then the author goes again, that's a real situation, though. Is there any reason why that should be legal? Blumenthal, I'm not sure I even know what you mean. The author, at 23 weeks into pregnancy, should abortion ever be legal if the baby's healthy and the mother is healthy? Blumenthal, you know, I just can't engage in speculation. The author again, I mean, there are studies that say that does happen. Blumenthal, send me those studies and I'd be glad to comment. Now he's dodging. He knows what he's asking. He's just dodging the question. I sent Blumenthal's office the 2013 study conducted by professors at University of California at San Francisco of women who got abortions later than 20 weeks into pregnancy. According to the study, quote, data suggests most women seeking later abortions are not doing so for reasons of fetal anomaly or life endangerment. The study points, for example, to one woman from Illinois discovered she was 23 weeks pregnant and had her abortion the same week. Given ample time to comment, Blumenthal's office has not applied. Every Senate Democrat running for president has endorsed the Women's Health Protection Act. When Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren were asked this week if abortion should ever be illegal, both said no. Well, both just kind of looked and dodged the question. Booker wouldn't answer it. He said, I believe that you should codify Roe v. Wade. But when he was asked if any abortion should ever be illegal, he went silent. Booker finally said with a smile when asked him if his silence should be interpreted as no, he simply said, you're a very good, dastardly good guy. Warren simply stuck to her talking points that she wanted to make Roe v. Wade a federal statute when she was asked if any late-term abortion should be ever be illegal. Here's how their colleague, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, responded to a question about elective abortions 23 weeks into pregnancy. He said this, quote, most of these decisions should be made by doctors, and I don't know many doctors who are into what do the extremists call infanticide. Never met a doctor who's for that. Never once. But doctors do perform elective late-term abortions. Dr. Leroy Cartwright was caught on tape saying he performed, quote, purely elective abortions up until 28 weeks into pregnancy. Another doctor named James Pendergraft has said he performed even later abortions under, quote, anxiety and stress, health exception. Dr. Caesar said he would let an infant born alive at 24 weeks after an attempted abortion suffocate to death. Dr. Steve Brigham kept a freezer full of aborted babies, one as old as 36 weeks. Some infants born at 22 weeks grow up to be healthy children and adults. And of course, there was Kermit Gosnell, who had likely murdered hundreds of infants born alive in addition to three murders for which there was enough evidence to convict him. What's the moral difference between what Kermit Gosnell did to babies born alive and legal abortions at 23 weeks? That's a question Nancy Pelosi could not answer after Gosnell was convicted in 2013. Cecile Richards, then president of Planned Parenthood, defended late-term abortion when the child is suffering from a severe abnormality. But what about when the child and mother are physically healthy? Richards went silent. This isn't a gotcha question. It's a question about fundamental human rights. There are likely thousands of elective abortions performed later than 20 weeks into pregnancy each year. If leading Democrats and advocates of a right to abortion are unwilling or unable to defend a right to abort healthy infants late in pregnancy, then why are they so committed to maintaining America's status as one of seven countries in the world that allows it? Think about that last sentence. The greatest country on the planet, the United States of America, is one of seven countries in the world that allow for late-term abortion. Folks, the reason why they won't answer the question when asked, is it ever okay for abortion to be illegal after 20 weeks, after 23 weeks, if mom and baby is healthy, is because they know that they're answering that question is going to upset a lot of people. And I frankly don't believe, as a rational human, you can even look at that and go, it's okay to end that life. So they just won't answer it. We'll talk more about that when we come back.
If they could see how much you're worth, your power, your might, your endless love, then surely they would never cease to praise you. Yeah. Everything that has been, praise the Lord.
So look, as we finish up today, I think it's important to note that when we have these debates and conversations and we look at what's being said by folks that are writing laws, what's being said by folks that are leaders in our country, it's important because if you're not paying attention, you'll hear somebody say, well that candidate's a moderate. Oh, well, they're a moderate, or they you know, they believe a lot like you. Look, maybe they're moderate on some issues. Maybe they may very well be. Not denying that. But when it comes to abortion, when it comes to Roe v. Wade, none of them are moderate. They all hold an extreme position. A position that the vast majority of the populace don't even hold. People that say they're pro-choice typically are not for abortion after 20 weeks. Pro-choice to them means, look, if somebody finds out they're pregnant, they should be able to get an abortion. But most people that you say, well, what if they're pregnant at 20 weeks and baby's healthy and the mom's healthy? Then they're going to say, well, yeah, they should have the baby, maybe place the baby for adoption, but they shouldn't be able to have an abortion. Now, I would argue that the baby at 20 weeks is just a little bit bigger, but no different than the baby at 1 week. And I get some people would say my view is an extreme view. But here's the thing. One extreme view ends life. One view that they claim is extreme doesn't end anybody's life. It actually saves a life. So which side of the fence do you want to be on? Like sometimes it's cliche and corny to say, which side of history will you be on? But the reality is, we're going to be on one side or the other. The reality is that I was just in D.C. a few weeks ago, and I'm walking through the Holocaust Museum, and at the end of it, there's names of people that saved a ton of Jews from being killed. Now, it's not a ton of people, but it's a small group of men and women that said, I'm going to stand up, I'm going to do something, and they saved people's lives because of it. Some of those men and women lost their own life in the process. But now we look back and we go, they were on the right side of history. We look back and we look back at the Civil War and we go, they were on the right side of history. We look back at a number of different things and we can see which is the right and which is the wrong side. Saying that life is precious and deserves protection in the womb is not extreme. It is natural and it is the position that we should hold. But saying with a straight face that abortion should be legal throughout the entire pregnancy for any reason, that is 100% extreme. And it should be called out as such. And as long as I have a platform to do that, I'm going to call it out. Because that is an extreme position. You can't point to polls to base your position on and then disregard the polls that say people want restrictions on abortion. You can't do that. Logically, you can't do that honestly. And so hopefully you enjoyed the conversation today. Hopefully you learned something today. And we'll continue as we always do next week. Thanks for listening.
If not us, then